Check, check. Yeah. You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio. Yo, coming in spitting like a bat out of hell. A lot of alt-right wanna see the Mac in a cell, but they aren't bright, what they try happen to fail. And they can't keep up, so they tattle and tell. But they are stupider, I stay on nuclear. Hit the law with a juke and then take a scooter to Jupiter. Ooh, what the hell does that mean? I don't know, but I go slow, yellow and green. Mellow ass lean, crossed legs in the fold arms. About to have a conversation with Soulcon. Dope knife, lingua franca is Voltron. Y'all ain't never heard shit, yo, hold on. Hey!
Yo! What's up? It's
Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
Hurry up, bastard.
No, how you doing?
I had to throw that in there in the spirit of our topic today.
You beat me to the punch because I was gonna like throw in one too, but
yeah. So to this week. Well, before we get into the topic this week, how are you? What's good? What's going on?
Oh, I'm good. Can't complain about much. Just super busy, but otherwise, you know, life is treating me pretty good.
You're in the
right
process
now.
Of opening a studio?
Yeah. I got myself a little studio space, so I'm like still in the process of getting all the equipment in and stuff like that. But you know, just doing little side project things. I started working on a new album too, but
fantastic. Yeah.
You know. All that sort of stuff. But we have a extremely stacked episode and one that I'm pretty excited to deliver. So I think we're just going to get into it. Today we're going to be talking about an aspect of this hip-hop thing that we both have some experience in. We might have mentioned it once or twice or a million times on the show before, but we're going to be talking about the art of battle rapping. Or should I say the culture of battle rapping? One of the two. The lines they're kind of blurry.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things, you know, when it comes to doing hip hop and also being I hate using the word conscious, but being, you know, involved or aware of politics, in your case involved in politics like directly.
Yeah.
You come across a lot of aspects of it that are kind of ingrained in the culture as it exists now that don't necessarily vibe with who you are politically or ideologically. We kind of touched on this in the More Money, More Problematic episode. But
right.
I would say, and we probably haven't experienced it as much, but because we, you know, we're both on the more on the recording performing side of things, but we have like, you know, background dabbling in battle rap. But the aspect that I think would probably find you conflicting with that the most would probably be battle rap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, akin to the Mo Money, Mo Problematic episode where we talk about like club bangers that you put on, you kind of ignore their lyrical content because it's so fi that like you just get in the moment. I think battle rap culture and then like the cipher as a space is another place where like you kind of have to leave your moral... your moral compass at the door.
Yeah.
Well, so we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
It's like, you know, a wise MC once told me when I was first starting, he was like, finding your voice as like a rapper, it's all about finding who you are. It's like who you are in real life, but with the volume turned way up. You know what I'm saying? And like, mm-hmm. The battle rap, when you get into battle rap mode, and like when you do it seriously, when you're like just, you know, messing around with your friends, it's one thing. But when you're like doing it in a competition format where you actually really want to win, that's when that like character mask comes on and you're like, you're not Kendrick Mack anymore. You know, because anybody who knows me personally, like I'm always smiling and shit. You know what I mean? But it's like in battle mode, you're like in a fugue state of rap and like lyrical sparring that it's kind of hard to describe. So we're going to get into that, and we're going to be talking about that very subject with battle rapper extraordinaire and leftist activist Soulcon, who's going to come up. We're going to talk about how he deals with that conflict, as well as his background in hip hop and how he got into battle rap and just how he's witnessed it evolve through the days. So getting into things, battle rap, you know, more or less is believed to have started in the East Coast of New York back in the 1980s. But Mariah, if you had to describe to somebody, like if someone, you know, hadn't even seen 8 Mile, like someone coming in that blind, if they just like asked you, what is battle rap? I heard of it. How would you describe it to them?
Well, I feel like someone might be familiar with the concept of freestyle, but ahead of their awareness of some of the conventions of battle rap as a subgenre within that general style. And so with freestyle, I mean, it's improvisation, it's metered, it's rhymed. But within battle rap, it's a contest. And so it's drawing on anything from the physical mannerisms, the manner of speech, where someone's from, of your fellow contestant, of the person who's stepping to you in that space, to determine who has not only the best lyricism with regards to like metaphors and analogies akin to the way we might evaluate rap writ large, but I think there's particularly a comedy component that you don't always see in a lot of other rappers. I mean, you see a little bits here and there, but particularly like making jokes on someone and making the crowd laugh, like, you know, making the crowd like freak out with your quick thought, but particularly like bringing someone down a peg with you know, references to what shoes they're wearing, what hat they got on, that you slept with your girlfriend, that sort of thing, as like the punchline.
A peg is a little bit of an understatement. You're trying to bring them down like a whole like 20 feet of bringing them down.
You're trying to make it so that they never return to that venue again.
Exactly.
Yes.
No, I agree with that description is like spot on. I think it's like when you get past the musical element of it, and we're going to get a little bit into that too, but once you get past the musical element of it, that it's, you know, rapping and, you know, over a beat, it's kind of like a battle of wits, you know, especially when you get into the freestyle zone. It's like, who, you know, because you can come in with stuff prepared or things in mind, but when you're reacting off of what the person said, and when that person's reacting off of what you said, or you're reacting off of things that happened during that day and you're bringing it up in the battle, like all of those things add to it. But you bringing up the comedic element, that pretty much is the key. That's like the strategy to like winning 80% of battles, is if you're funny and if you make people laugh at your opponent, you know, that's kind of the goal right there. So however you can do that, I know some people that are able to do that in like a very self-deprecating Seinfeld sort of way. There are people who are able to do that in like a tough guy screaming sort of way, and everything in between, but that's kind of the goal of it.
I will never forget this particular rap battle I was in, where this MC I was up against won the battle by taking away everything I could possibly say about him. I was up against this like short white guy, and everyone always made fun of him for being short and white, and like, you know, Eminem comparisons. And like, he got up there and was just like super self-deprecating, and had everybody rolling, losing their minds, laughing. And I had nothing left to make a joke about him about, because like, what am I gonna call him, short again? Like, what am I gonna, you know, like call him the Keebler elf? He literally just did that. And so, yeah, there is, you can flip it on its head, but mostly those, you know, slights are aimed at your opponent. But I think where this intersects with like one's personal politics is like, you're discursively positioning yourself in the space in a hierarchy of skill with regards to your linguistic dexterity, etc. But in the joke making aspect, you're also positioning yourself in hierarchies along lines of race, gender, class, ethnicity, sexuality, street affiliation. So you're putting somebody down like, oh, like, you know, you ain't really black, or you're a woman, or you're gay, or I think you're gay, or oh, you're Mexican, or you're Latino, or you're Latino, or you're Asian, as a way of like, through the wordplay, creating a hierarchy, you know, based on like the straight black male is at the top of the hierarchy in a battle rap space, and everybody else, like whether real or perceived, trying to put someone on, you know, a lower rung than you. And so whether or not that actually aligns with your politics outside of that space you know, whether or not you really like think Latinos are less than you, or you really want to go around making jokes about LGBTQ people, is where like the moral rug gets a little slippery under your feet.
Yeah.
In this space, and I guess like something that we want to kind of unpack today.
I've definitely been in some circles where I've been in, you know, a lot of odd hip hop circles, but I've been in a lot of battle spaces where, you know, it's in real life, it's like all sorts of people who are there on all different, you know, from all different walks of life. But within the confines of the arena of battle rap, there's kind of like that understanding amongst everybody that, you know, it's just battle rap. You know what I'm saying? So from that aspect, people who are in those spaces don't really take it that way, but to like an outsider being in there, it's like you're listening to it, you're like, oh my God, can you believe that person said XYZ? And can you believe that other person said XYZ? This is crazy. And then the two of them are like shaking hands and getting a drink and like smiling afterwards. And, you know, it's
exactly. Yeah. And I often reference that aspect of battle rap as like very formative for like how I operate within the political sphere and why I think that battle rapping and freestyling activities like that actually gear people up for like civic leadership in this weird way. Because like when I go to a meeting at City Hall, I can like be yelling until I'm spitting in people's face, but afterwards like, oh, you know, have a good night, Mike. How's your wife and shit? Just like in a battle when someone come at me like, oh, you're lesbian, you don't shave your legs and your hair nappy and la la la, and then like, but at the end of it, like you dap and you have a shot together and it's like all good and all chill.
Yeah.
Particularly with,
go for it. No. I have a good story, but I'll tell it at the end of it. But yeah, so let's get into some of the earliest references to battling. So
yeah, you brought up that battle rap started with East Coast hip hop during the 1980s, but really this ritual or this tradition of ritual insult within the Black community goes back, you know, it was first documented by Yale psychologist John Dollard in 1939 when he was taking a look at the way people played the dozens. So trading verbal insults in a joking manner before an audience of associates, you know, jabbing at people about hygiene, alleged sex, homosexuality, ugliness, intelligence, your mama, etc. goes way, 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 way back in just like Black vernacular culture generally. But then as we found our voice musically with hip hop in the 1980s, 1990s, like it sort of got retooled as a way of resolving beef, a way of showing your linguistic dexterity, the way that you would do the same over a beat in a non like competitive manner. But yeah, so it has deep, deep roots in just the way that I guess Black culture's love of language play and also just like kind of fucking with each other in a fun,
exactly,
playful way. Yeah.
Some of you out there, you might have heard, you know, your experience with battling, if you haven't like checked out some things on YouTube, you know, perhaps you know about the new renditions of battling, which involves two people reciting, I mean, I guess you could say it's like almost poetry in a way, like spoken word rhyming poems that are, you know, with the same sort of intent that battle rap has, but it's over no music and, you know, one person takes a turn, the other person takes a turn, and it's pre-written and they memorize it before they go in. And there's an art and a whole culture to that in itself. The battling that I'm used to is, I guess at this point, is a traditional, I guess it's considered, but it's the freestyling off of the top of the head. You know, one person goes for 45 seconds or something, the next person goes for the same, and maybe you do two rounds of that. The crowd and some judges determines the winner. What do you think about the new style of battling, I guess?
Not into it. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, people, older generations are always hating on the new thing, right? So like, hip-hop in general isn't as good as it used to be, like you hear old heads say. And so I'm not trying to be that person and being like, well, that's not real battle rap, that's not what it's supposed to be, da 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 da. But I personally just value the ingenuity of improvisation over you wrote some shit down ahead of time and like
was looking at somebody's Facebook page for months.
I just
checking out who their girlfriend is, where they work, you know what I mean? And like,
yeah,
I like music, you know, and there's the element of like the fact that battling is like a musical, was always a musical competition to me is what was appealing in it. Like, no disrespect, but I'm just not like, I'm not the sort of cat who goes to like slam poetry events because it's just not my jam. You know what I mean? So the acapella battling kind of has that vibe to it. You know, it feels to me like you just kind of have to be dope with words, which is a whole skill and discipline in itself. But I don't think you necessarily have to be a good rapper to be good at doing that stuff. You know, and I talk about all this sort of things with Sokan too, by the way. It's pretty long. You think we should get it started?
Yeah, let's hop into it.
All right, we're going to be back with leftist activist and battle rapper extraordinaire Sokan right after the jump. All right, y'all. So we are about to chat with someone who I'm a huge fan of. He is a MC of the highest caliber and also an activist. It's my homie Sokan. What's up, man?
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you taking the time to come talk with me, man. So how's life been treating you in this crazy world the last year or two?
I think it's okay. I mean, it's... I would say that I am encountering more, as in the last year, I've encountered more hurdles than some and far fewer than others. But a lot of it having to do with just the emotional toll and the physical toll of living in a much less connected, physically connected world, especially because I live in New York City, and that is and one of the reasons I love it is what's usually the life of the city and how many people are always here and moving and engaging with each other and, you know, at all sorts of hours, and seeing that necessarily contract in the name of, you know, public health goals. It's been tough.
Yeah.
It's been tough. It's really tough. For the first couple months of the pandemic, I did not leave a 10-block radius, basically, except for a couple times.
Yeah, no, I feel you on that. I was the same exact way. Yeah.
So, but I'm, you know, there are nice developments in my personal and professional life. I've got new music on the way too, and that's so. I'm, you know, and there's a very energized, though reasonably embittered, left wing in America that's fighting for what they need to. So that's also good.
Well, I want to like delve into a lot of that with you, like heavy. But I guess let's get some of the burning questions at the top of my brain out of the way first. So, how did you get into hip hop?
I got into hip hop because of two things at once, basically. One of which was MTV, which I was not supposed to watch when I was a young kid. Not that I think that it was a... I think if I were to not... If I was... If back then, if there were reasons to not watch MTV, it wasn't for the reasons that you think. It might have been because, like, at the end of the day, it was, like, them just selling people stuff. That's commercial television. But I think my family thought it might be, like, two adults or whatever, but, like, it was fine. But it was MTV in tandem with my mom's selection of radio stations in the morning when she'd take me to school. She would always... you know, listen to either like oldies, news, or rap. That's it.
Oh, word. So your mom's a hip hop fan?
She is, to a lesser extent than I am, but but she's, you know, both as a result of what I got into and where I went with my music and who I worked with, you know, she has sustained her know, a connection with the music as a listener.
So that's how you got into it. But at what point or what prompted you to start wanting to make it?
I started rapping when I was about 13 years old. Badly, very badly. And
all of us did.
Yeah, but like, there, you know, I was the, whatever a wunderkind is, I was the opposite of it. Like a blunderkind or something. I was dreadful. And I was always trying to sound like someone else. And didn't really have a real sense of my actual voice and my distinct voice then. I was also a teenager, and it was this way for a long time.
Yeah.
Had like ciphers in high school and middle school, and or in high school though, but like high school and when I went to college, you know, and I'd periodically go to places like Project Blood because I was in LA, even though it was like a bajillion year ride from my corner of the valley to there, or like go to like other events and stuff, places like The Basement. I had a somewhat, if not a tenuous, sort of like corporeal connection to a hip hop community in LA. It just was, you know, because of geography, it was very limited. And I didn't drive at all in Los Angeles.
Yeah. That'll make it hard to get around.
Yeah, relied on the kindness of friends. And, you know, so if I wanted to go anywhere to see anything, it would have to be either because, you know, my mom felt fine to drive me there. She always was supportive of just, you know, time. Yeah. She was in my teens, she was a single mother. And
what you
mean,
do?
She was a library clerk. And she, I mean, honestly, given the quality of the fathering in my household, she was kind of a single parent the whole time in most regards. And when I got to college, I formed a rap group, me and a couple friends, and as I approached the end of college, one of my friends was, you know, talking to me about what we were going to do, you know, what everyone's plans were, and one of one of the kids who was younger, just by a couple years than me, I told him, like, oh, you know, I think I'm probably going to, like, work in, like, a congressperson's office or something. You know, like that was going to be the trajectory, and then we'll see what goes, where we go from there. And they said, well, that type of job will be around, for a little bit at least. There are routes to get into it. It was very, like, insightful take from a 20-year-old, and but they said, you know, rapping might not be, and back then, you know, these are the early aughts,
yeah,
the age stigma was just wildly in effect still, you know. Yeah, now no one gives a shit.
You mean the age stigma in terms of like, I can't be a 30-year-old
exactly.
rapper.
Exactly. Like, and that's now no one gives a damn about that, which is beautiful. I think that actually there are factors behind that.
It was really bad back
then,
though.
Horrific.
Like everybody was setting that deadline on themselves. Like cats that are dope were like, yeah, man, I just got two more years in the game. And then it's mad funny when you think that like, some of the motherfuckers just dropped like an album like yesterday.
But. Yeah. And like, and there's, you know, 2 Chainz blew up finally at the age of 36.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? I mean, obviously a player circle, but like the explosion.
Explosion.
It's like 36 years old.
Killer Mike and LP. Killer Mike,
yeah. They're adults. Ka. Yeah. And also a shout out to Ka, dear man, who is obviously doing, has done great work professionally as a musician outside of music too. But yeah, the longevity is that, you know, I think hip hop grew up, I think a lot because of the fans grew up too, and they recognize, and also a lot of even the, I feel like at a certain point, all of the because the music industry fell apart and all the people who used to be just like chasing the next new big thing couldn't dictate the terms of everything that would blow up, other voices and other people's tastes were able to, people who valued talent regardless of the age were able to say like, no, this is still worth it. You don't have to try to chase what the kids are into. We're not kids. Get over it. Like,
exactly. It's like
there is a lane for that, but it's not this.
Yeah, and it's probably best reserved for kids.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, and that's fair.
There can be, I don't know. It's just like, I don't know why anyone, if those people are even still out there, but I don't know why anyone has that sort of view that like hip hop has to be like this homogenous thing. It's like, nah, like there should be adult oriented rap music and,
exactly,
you know, young adult. There should be like Harry Potter version, young adult novel rap, and, you know, like wild clubs. You know, there should be room for all of that. I think people sometimes almost like do a straw man of trying to say that, oh, why are heads who are like, you know, more along the lines of like that sort of quote unquote, you know, true school, old school, you know, vein of things. It's not necessarily that the diversity in styles and stuff is an issue. It's just merely like, it's more of a media criticism in terms of like the balance and what gets exposure and what doesn't, you know.
Absolutely. And you know, it's funny, I was thinking that, well, we can talk more about it later, but like, this is, I've been thinking a lot about that, about who sets the parameters for who becomes famous, and just thinking about how even, the other day, like, I tweeted, like, it was really, you know, no one's had as rapid or widely celebrated of an ascendance as DMX did. And it's crazy to think that even back then, a very, like, major label-driven thing, like his like, prime era, it felt almost like more authentic than a lot of stuff does now, because it was out in the open and they were like, yes, Def Jam Records wants you to listen to DMX, versus now it's like an independent team that secretly was programmed by, you know, a PR agency and a brand partnership with, you know, a beverage company is organically suggesting that you get into this cool new artist that totally isn't a product of engineering that we did. Like, it's very, you know, that, and
it's very, there's a plasticness about shit. I mean, you know, I not to go too wild all over the place, but I find it is in like a lot of entertainment mediums where it's just like, there's this aura of like, I don't know, it almost feels like it's the 80s. Like, it feels like a parody of like somebody making fun of how the 80s were, where it's like everything is just really like soulless, and the there is no pretense that capital is the biggest motivating factor for why everything exists.
Absolutely.
You know?
And then there's, they still try to put on the veneer of relatability, like, you know, the classic example being brands tweeting.
Like, yes,
the brand that tweets is the real soul of soullessness.
you should, if you watch like a making of on like a DVD that was made in like 2007, and then you watch the making of for a movie that was made like 2 years ago, just look at the difference in what they're presenting you is like the behind the scenes look. It's like one of them is clearly like a reality show. Fake shit.
Hell yeah, I'm excited.
It's really weird.
That's a good challenge. I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna pick a good. I gotta pick a real good one, and just now I'm hyped for that.
Okay, so I'm sorry not to get too off topic. What was the name of your rap group?
Oh, back then it was called BPM.
What was that? What did that stand for?
It was Beat People's Movement. Like,
beats. Not bad. That's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the
word.
That's
not bad.
But someone could also have mistaken it for us saying, like, being like a paramilitary or something, or an attack squad. You know, like the, but we Yeah, it meant like beats. It meant beats, you know.
Yeah.
It was, and I think it was sort of one of those reverse engineered things where we thought, like, it would be cool to call ourselves BPM. Okay, what does BPM stand for?
Yeah, coming up with the meeting afterwards.
Absolutely. And that's fine. You know,
Some of my first tattoos kind of have that sort of vibe going on.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, I mean, it's sort of like, and that's sort of like that also is true, this the spirit of songwriting in some cases, where you like the way some words rhyme, and then you're like, what do I have to say that will make these words make sense?
Yeah.
That sound good. It happens all the time. I think we don't want to do it too often because it feels like.
You can tell. You can tell when somebody is doing that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's usually glaring if they're not like a really good rapper. Then cover it up. Sometimes it's the worst. Just sitting with a couplet or like a rhyme scheme, where you're like, I could, if I make this happen, I've triumphed. I've conquered rap. And you sit there for 20 minutes, and you're like, oh. Let's think of something else. Let's try something else. Otherwise, I'll hate my life, myself, and this art form that I'm trying to be still contributing to. So,
you know, the way that I heard of you was through the battle scene.
Yeah.
And this is like, I want to, if I'm going back to when, like, the first video that I can recall seeing of you, I mean, it must have been like
2009 was when my first one came, or maybe 2008.
It was around 2009, 2010 November, when I saw something. It's like, I think I saw like Grind Time stuff. Yeah. Now see, it's like I have a nuanced relationship with that style of battling, because the scene that I came up in was the freestyle scene.
Absolutely. And there's still like run. There was an overlap there.
Yeah. At that time period, there was like, I had missed out on, because my father worked for the State Department, so I grew up overseas and shit. So by the time I had come, here to go to college, Scribble Jam and stuff like that was going on, and I wasn't like established enough to get into that scene. When that started dying out is when the Grind Time stuff started kind of rising.
Absolutely.
And did you do both?
I actually did, because there was no New York. I think I either missed or there wasn't a New York City Scribble Jam qualifier in 2007. And so I went to Traverse City, Michigan by myself.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to do. And I did the Scribble prelims there. And I was in the finals of the Scribble prelims for Michigan. which is hilarious, for Traverse City. I don't know if there was a Detroit one, which is wild to think about.
Shit, I'm messing up, because so we don't be too insider.
Yeah.
So Scribble Jam was a huge hip hop festival in the, what do you want to say, late 90s, early
2000s? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it started in 96, I think. Maybe
okay,
95.
So, yeah, and I mean, it has a huge legacy. For example, the most famous one is Eminem.
Yes.
Came in second place at Scribble Jam, and I guess he handed off his demo, or at least the legend goes, or something like that. But Scribble Jam, it was the rap
Olympics is where he did, I think, really, really blow up. Yeah. And Scribble Jam, though, was a big moment with him versus Juice.
Did you do freestyle battling?
Yes, so
obviously
did.
If you were in,
I did freestyle battling. I was freestyling on Grind Time for the first couple battles with maybe some like premeditated stuff. I didn't write anything down because I thought, oh, that's cheating, and everyone's still freestyling except for maybe the people who did raps that were like more general and weren't personal. And when I found out that everyone was writing after my first battle that I lost in Grind Time, I was like, oh, whoops, okay, I'm not going to lose another one. We're done with that. We're going to win everything.
Describe to the listeners, right? There's two different battle, I guess. Would the word be scenes or styles?
It's both, because there's definitely a regional difference and regional emphasis on spontaneous freestyling in the West Coast more so. Not to say it wasn't present at all, and also in like the Midwest. Whereas in New York, it would be more about like, honestly, having zero personally relevant material, but like relying largely on stuff that's like, because there were the DVD battle scene was really big in New York and over the East Coast.
But describe the difference.
The difference is like between freestyling on beat, so spontaneous raps about and against your opponent over a beat that you both get to rap over, taking turns, usually like 30 seconds to a minute per round. And the other style at the time, which has prevailed in a lot of ways, like these basically people rapping a cappella for several minutes at a time, basically doing verses. Like they could be like it was a rap battle, but like you could, for a lot of cases, you could have used their verses against one person interchange on a song or against anybody else they'd face. And it's just sort of a rap contest, like how well someone could rap versus how well versus the freestyle one, which is a lot more about like how well can you diss your opponent directly and in a relevant way to them.
So I've always had this analogy that I've made with it, that I'm sure somebody who is as accomplished as you are in the written battle scene is but I want to share it with you anyway, just to see what you think of it, right? So I always kind of looked at it as freestyle battling and the pre-written battling. It's like the difference between UFC and WWE.
Yes, very
when,
much so.
When you watch a UFC match, you honestly can see anything. It might be the greatest fight you've ever seen, or somebody might get knocked out in the first 5 seconds, or like anything could happen. Like somebody might be nervous and mess up and get knocked out. And whereas with like a WWE match, it's like it's all choreographed so that you, the watcher, are entertained. No, like everyone's gonna get to do their moves. You're gonna get to see everybody like perform and show out, and then you know the winner is determined later.
Absolutely, and I think people like, I think wrestling fans care less about, like WWE fans care less about outcomes than performance.
Mm-hmm.
They care less about like who won the match versus who. Who did the coolest shit?
Coolest stuff, yeah.
It's like, that's it. That's what matters. And I feel like that, it's a good analogy. Obviously, like, there are technically winners and losers sometimes. They'll judge battles, in written battles. They used to judge them more. But, you know, I got over the whole non-judged battle hang-up that I used to have once I did a non-judge battle. It's not like, oh, no one cares.
So did you like stop? I mean, I know you like, I guess you didn't do battles for a long time, and then you came back and did a battle.
I did a battle not too.
Was it like a year or two ago?
Yeah, it wasn't a very auspicious return because I think I was doing too much other stuff, and like I was coming off of a divorce, a difficult work year, and like transitioning to different medications. Like it was a rough time.
Damn.
And like I was like in a not super healthy relationship, so I ate shit as far as I'm concerned in that return battle against Disaster, and I have always owned that. There were some glimmers and flickers I think that would have been better, but like I flew directly from like a work event to go to Oakland. I was like nauseous the whole time because I was like transitioning back from Trintellix to Wellbutrin. And I just was not ready, you know, and I was just misallocating my time, both in terms of the prep that I was doing and just the time between deciding how much time I would spend preparing versus not preparing, you know, and I bit off more than I could chew. I thought that I was writing something that would fill up I think if I wrapped it at normal speed, my return battle versus would have filled like maybe 20 minutes instead of like 45. Yeah. But I was like sort of mentally stuck trying to remember all my stuff, basically doing like something that was just like a speech at a certain point. And I hated it as it was happening. And it killed me to like be in the moment and feel that. Like it was fun. Like Diz did really well, except for the material that was unnecessarily problematic, because he would have won without it easily.
So I mean, do you think you're gonna take another shot?
There are a couple impediments to that, one of which is that it's just so much time,
yeah,
and attention and energy.
Like I don't even know exactly what the full story is behind why you left, actually.
I just wanted to do music only. That was it.
Okay.
There was a stigma then, and there isn't now, I don't think, really. Like you can, if a new battle rapper can drop music, and granted, it'll be tougher to get it out there without having some of the music only platforms pushing you. Mm-hmm. Like if you're not on any blogs or playlists or whatever, like it will be tough. You can't just do it via battle rap unless just the algorithm blesses you.
Yeah.
Or if you have like a publicist working or something. But then in 2010, and the less I battled and the more I distanced myself from it, the more music opportunities came my way.
Word.
Like a switch flipped, and it was not fair. Like that doesn't, I think folks took that personally, battle fans and battlers, and thought, oh, I thought it was too good for it. It's like, nah, I had a different priority. I went for that, and it wasn't anyone's fault that that's how the market and the climate was then. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more rewarding to do both like monetarily and in terms of energy that you put into it. It's a lot more rewarding to make a song that you can perform over and over and over again, or have people play over and over and over again in a variety of settings, than it is to do a battle that's so much more writing that has one use.
Yeah, and, which is just the battle.
Yeah, and I could, you know, but so it's a lot of time, it's a lot of energy to put into it, and I think I could do it. I could make up for my performance the first time around. The other issue is that, like, I think a lot of battle rap and fans, I think, are mad at me because of like a Twitter controversy like a year ago.
Do you care to elaborate?
I'll elaborate. Yeah, no, because I think it's important to explore, because there's a lot of misconceptions about it and like opportunistic people who just don't like me for standing for anything and actually living up to it. Who like snaps jumped upon us, like a lot of rap vloggers and stuff, like battle rap vloggers and stuff.
Is this something that would be better prefaced by us talking about some of your activism work?
No, I think it's fine. I mean, like, just so people know, like, I've always been a leftist, but I haven't always embodied those principles when it came to my art, both battling and music. I'd have content that was, you know, misogynistic, homophobic, like racially insensitive, you know, basically all stuff that, like, on a level that like stand-up comedy thought was okay.
Yeah.
As of then.
Yeah.
And I was like buying into that because I thought it's just a joke or it's just a line. And, you know, I grappled with that, and I've spent a decade reckoning with that and still reckon with it publicly and privately and with anyone I meet who discovers that I have rapped in any of these settings. And I could be doing that for the rest of my life. And that's the onus that one has when they do something that has consequences like that, regardless of my intentions. And, you know, that being said, so there was, back when, and I, you know, I'll say this, I recognize where I erred on this totally, but there are places where I did not, where I was miscast by a lot of opportunistic folks. So like right after Kobe Bryant passed away, in that, you know, tragic helicopter accident, and he and his daughter. And I saw, there are a lot of folks dear to me who were survivors of sexual assault. And at the time, there were folks who wanted to even talk about that dimension of Kobe Bryant's life, not to perpetually condemn him, but to like be mindful of how it might impact other people who are survivors of sexual assault, and not to like relitigate it even, but just to like not erase it.
Yeah.
And especially given the fact that he himself made efforts to reckon with this, and which is rare, which is very rare for someone of his prominence. And I initially tweeted something to the effect of like, you know, people are saying it's offensive to mention sexual assault. So how offensive is sexual assault itself? You know, like people were getting more offended about the mention of a thing than the thing itself being overlooked or being, and like, so like a couple places where I fucked up is like timing wise, you know, I did it like the day after it happened. And I think I was just very reactive and raw and feeling sad seeing my friends of different genders, racial backgrounds, who had experienced sexual assault, feeling like diminished. And there are ways to not diminish them or that issue while still recognizing the many, accomplishments and virtues and of Kobe Bryant and mourning him. Mm-hmm. And I sort of just like got people's responses to me, aside from just like being upset at the timing, where also people trying to say like, oh, this stuff never happened. You're like trying to, you know, they're like comparing what I was saying to like Emmett Till. And I was like, yo, and people were like, oh, are you trying to be like, he was, you know, found not guilty in court. I was like, the court system doesn't do anything. I was like, I don't believe in the court system. Like, I think people got it twisted. They thought like, I thought we're saying the dude should have gone to jail.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in jail. I don't believe in police. I don't believe in prisons. I don't think a lot of survivors of sexual assault don't believe in that stuff or don't think that they'll find healing in that stuff, largely because they don't even when it's actually addressed by these systems. So I was talking about sort of like, my whole comment initially was just about like public record and discourse and sort of talking about an issue. And it got buried in like issues of like insensitivity about the timing of the tweet, and then like my defensiveness against people, and you know, I think, you know, there were a lot of battle rap folks who were like fans, battle rap fans, who probably never listened to my music or anything, and probably never read anything. They probably, you know, probably only started paying attention to me again because of my coming back to battling, were like just not in good faith dealing with what I said or my attempt to address it after.
Just trying to make it the worst possible interpretation.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a YouTube video of someone saying like Soul Con said, like some battle rap blogger and a rap, they like blog about other stuff too, but like this is like Soul Con says that mourning Kobe is disrespectful to sexual assault victims. Like, I literally never said that. But that was like the 10, like I literally, there's a tweet that says, I didn't say that you shouldn't mourn this man. I did not say, like, there's nowhere I said that whatsoever. Hell, there were, like, even some, like, sort of legitimate journalists who I know who were, like, trying to, like, milk this for, like, clicks and likes. And it's embarrassing. And you know what? And the funny thing at the end of the day is people like to pick and choose what they're offended by or what they find to be outrageous. You know, because I never, you know, and then finally, ironically, I had a line in a battle about, like, when I disses Dude Fox, and I basically said that he would, like, people say he looked like Kobe, but he was actually the one who was getting, I'll paraphrase, assaulted in this. Just terrible, you know, it was terrible then. But these people were going nuts for that. These same folks probably were losing their mind. My biggest battle, 3 million views. Never has anyone at that time, and that was years. That was several years after the you know, the assault, that case. Yeah. And was that okay? Where were the comments then? I'm not saying even that like you can't change your mind about things. Or change your mind about how you reacted to things. Or, you know, I'm living proof of that. And everyone should evolve, and everyone should think about these things in an active, evolving way. But no one cared, Ben. No one cared when, like, Diz in the movie Bodied, even, you know, which is supposed to be like the battle rap movie post 8 Mile.
Haven't seen that yet.
It's interesting. Joseph Kahn, the guy who made it, is a knobhead. He sucks, but like based on his really shitty, all lives matter-ish attitude about everything that's been swelling recently.
Yeah.
But Diz has a lot, and I'm not. This is not me being like to knock Diz, but just rather like no one. There was no outcry when this movie came out only a few years ago, where he brought this up earnestly, not like with a wink, like, oh, he didn't do it. Like, he said a line that is premised on the assumption that you think that this man is referred to did commit sexual assault. You know, like, so people pick and choose. I mean, like, Roan had a line about Eric, like, calling Big T, like, Eric Garner, like, mere years. Like, and that's, again, he can move past that. I bet he regrets it. I'm almost sure of it. But people really just, I think people wanted a reason to get me out of here or whatever they want to do with battle rap.
You know, Childish Gambino had a Trayvon line.
Oh, yeah. I think
he said, I would die for my hood, Trayvon.
Yeah. Like and I'm sure there, in his mind then he was like, oh yeah, this is really powerful.
Yeah.
There's no problem here. But yeah, so like that happened, and I think there was talk about me. I feel like that might be one reason I might not get booked again by a lot of folks.
What?
And that's fine. But here's the thing. If they're not going to book me based on that, that's fine. My Spotify numbers didn't go down at all. My YouTube subscribers didn't go down. My type, you know, the music fans stayed, as they always have, even though I'm a turtle about releasing things. So that whole controversy, I like dipped off Twitter for a couple months, just like let people's feel like I got off, you know, of Twitter for a little bit after that, and Instagram, just because I thought, let people not have to see my face and get re-aggravated.
Yeah.
It wasn't about me, like, because I mean, hell, I did get some death threats, which sucked, but like, you know, I'm always legally armed, so like I don't really sweat it too much. And I will leave it mysterious as to what that means exactly, but there's I think that like it felt like no one would get a chance to get over it, and I don't mean that in like a just get over me, but like to really genuinely like not have to. People were upset about his death. I don't need to. They don't need frustration with me compounded with it. So I was like, all right, I'll be out for a little bit.
So you mentioned earlier that not at all, you know, you've always been a leftist, but that hasn't always been reflected in your art or how you've. So how do you find like reconciling your leftist principles with not only the art that you make, but just the genre that you're involved in? I mean, just earlier, you know, this is definitely a leftist podcast, but, you know, just. Earlier, me and you were kind of reminiscing DMX.
Yeah.
What I'm saying? Totally. Who, if you go through DMX catalog, you're going to find a lot of bars here and there that aren't, you know, especially in 2021.
Oh, yeah.
Are gonna be looked at as quote unquote problematic. So, like, how do you reconcile that personally?
I think it's for my part, like my contributions, I just, for the stuff I've already done that I don't approve of, I just, for the most part, I just sort of like have a general overall disclaimer for it that, you know, I regret a lot of it. And if someone wants to talk about it and air what they're feeling about it, I will always be receptive to that. That's my responsibility. Anyone who is hurt by directly or indirectly anything I've ever rapped, it is there for the criticizing, as I think any art is, but like as the artist, I encourage people, not that they usually take me up on this, but like, because I think you can tell, like I'm earnest about it, but if someone feels like there's something I haven't addressed in my back catalog, whether songs or battles, that is screwed up, then I'm fine addressing that. And not in a like, oh, I'm sorry you were offended way, but in a way that hopefully affirms their experiences and their feelings and shows that I sincerely learn from it, and that it's hopefully I wouldn't repeat such indignities. And there might be stuff that I dropped on my last project, you know, this past year, that I'll regret in a little bit too. I don't think so. Like, I even like changed, there's some stuff I changed going in. Like, I had one line about like, like, would you stand up or just stare at your feet, embarrassed, something like embarrassed, too scared to compete. And it like, I, before the lines, this is like a, like when I first read, this is an old, not old verse, but it's a repurposed older verse from like a little while ago, not like a decade ago, but it said like, stare at your feet or like remain in your seat like a paraplegic. And it's sort of like, the rhyme scheme sounded dope, but like, it basically was inadvertently kind of, it was ableist, you know? Like likening paraplegism and a disability to a like a lack of courage, basically, in the context of that line.
Yeah.
Like this, like likening standing up as they, you know, which, I mean, remain in your seat, still maybe like that's a stretch with that point, but the fact that I outright had it like the word paraplegic in there was like,
yeah.
Nah, I don't need it. And so like when I had the chance to like redo this song for this project, I was like, that's gonna change.
It's interesting, you know, I was talking to Mortal Technique a couple weeks ago, and he was saying, he was on the show, and he was saying that on his next album, The Middle Passage, whenever that comes out, he said he doesn't use the N-word at all. Like, he's like, that's taken, he's like, that's out of his vocabulary, even in regular life too. So that was, you know, people change.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. It's fair to admit. It's fair to... I think it's just, if people are honest about it, that's what matters. If you're honest and open to have a, like a good faith talk about it and grow from it, that's what matters. If I don't think the point is to like perpetually self-flagellate and perpetually get... Like, I think that we also need to have a society where people can... not just to be rewarded for their growth, but where they aren't perpetually, you know, condemned for it, you know? And unfortunately, the internet doesn't help with that. This isn't about like cancel culture. It's rather about like the unproductivity of accountability culture sometimes, because of the fact that like cyclically, someone will like discover a bad media moment for the first time from someone who's famous, even though it's already been litigated before years ago, over and over again. And there has to be some mores or sort of norms around that. It's not, can't be formalized, because that sort of thing isn't something you could really formalize, but think we just need to sort of promote the idea that if X person who did Y bad thing makes earnest amends, that we don't forget about everything. What's the point of amends if it's for, you know, you don't learn something from that. But people can feel like they have the room to go on, and we don't. And the problem is, it's funny that the people who complain most about like cancel culture, like usually conservatives who help build such and sustain a very punitive society.
Of course.
You know, like, and the ones who are always like, if they didn't create this punitive society, then they wouldn't have punitive, judgmental norms around everything. And then make them afraid. So like the whole like idea of like, it's the irony of like, if Brett Kavanaugh hadn't been part of the world that Brett Kavanaugh built, there might have been a restorative justice space for everything that he did, you know, but there isn't, because of men like him, which is why, you know, and that, I think that the same goes for like the anti PC culture folks.
Yeah, no, all the anti-SJW types.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if they in other aspects of life are very punitive, are very, you know, love to shut down stuff that they don't like. So they're helping.
I mean, that's like the whole chief organizing principle of their shit is to shut down stuff that they don't like.
It's a fascism shuffle.
It's strictly just like what is it that they like? You know what I mean? It's like they literally don't even view it that way. It's like they have a blind spot in their mind that they can't even put that into a context. How they're like actually the biggest cancelers of anybody in the country.
The ultimate conclusion is like just like violent fascism, but like one of the places they go is like you end up with someone like Steven Crowder, who's like wandering around at different Planet Fitnesses or Crunch Fitness or wherever, pretending to be a trans person, and just being obnoxious just for any gender, and being like, oh look, they're like these insane studs, and because they don't actually have any positive vision of what life could be and how it could be better.
Crowder reminds me, like, there was this, about when I was a kid, there was this comic book. It was like a Superman story where like Superman landed in communist Russia and Red Sun, and he grew up to be like a communist. Steven Crowder is like if Jim Carrey's shuttle that brought him to Earth like landed in Rush Limbaugh's yard, and
absolutely, yeah. No, that's a great. Yeah, it's weird because you have these folks who just because they either didn't get or they rejected an intellectual and cultural framework of like rational, like modern thought.
Yeah,
they're stuck with this shit. They're trying to fit, you know, a critique of modern shit into a very old-fashioned, narrow-minded, and uncreative peg. They can't do it. They can't square it because it's not built for that. No. I mean, like, you have people like, they're like anti-postmodernism, even? Like, you have people like, which doesn't, you can't compete critically then if you think things like that. You're capable.
There's nothing like hearing somebody who's obviously stupid say stuff like postmodernism.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like seeing some like neckbeard anti-SJW YouTuber like, it's cultural Marxism, postmodern. Like, yo, shut the fuck up, dude. Like,
and if people haven't watched, I think the best sort of video exploration of this issue is Natalie Wynn's aka ContraPoints video about Jordan Peterson. Recommend.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like it really delves into how it's a whole movement that is predicated on having basically not done the reading. You really have to like, and heck, that happened when Slavoj Žižek and Jordan Peterson debated. You could tell.
He was like out of his depth.
Bloodbath. It was terrible. It's like you know, these these right wingers, especially like this YouTube crowd and the internet era folks, they tend to be very uninformed or have wholly misinterpreted like the whole canon that they think that they know. They don't understand shit. And it's but you know, to be fair, a lot of them wouldn't think the way they do if they did understand it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And whereas there are other folks who do understand this stuff and they don't care. And they don't try to have the veneer of like, no, my vision of society is better for everybody. It's, I don't care if my vision of society is better for everybody. That's not the point of society to me, or this point of life. That type of conservative or right.
That's, I think that's starting to be the dominant form. Like that's,
they're coming back. They're coming. Yeah. Cause that was the thing. And I think that even Trump folks try to like, they want to feel good about themselves as people. I think everyone wants to, but like they like want to talk about how Trump like helped black people, for instance. Like this is the lowest black unemployment ever. I think there's a conservative strain that's like, who gives a shit? They don't care about that either, and they are going to be more openly genocidal in their rhetoric.
Yeah, and also right now I think like their game is pretty much about like securing the bag first. Like I think they're trying to be more inclusive as long as everybody's under the umbrella of fascism. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? So well, it's like, what are you doing? Are you Candace Owens? You black? But are you fascist? All right, you're cool. What are you doing? Milo, you're gay? But are you fascist? All right, come on, you're with us. You know what I'm saying? I think they're at that 100% stage now. And then if they were to get their way, then they would worry about the particulars afterwards.
Exactly. And that's been the game. And I think people need to look at that's when you know, I caution friends of mine who would be like, oh, you know, like when gay marriage became legal, they'd be like, oh, this is amazing. If things are gone the way are and toward a brighter future. I'm like, there are like active, like LGBT fascists in Europe.
Yeah.
Prominent, and that's, and then fast forward, we got Milo. Fast forward, you know, like it's not a. We need to chill on the whole like premature congratulations on a brighter tomorrow because
we're not there yet.
And it adapts. Like if capital can co-opt anybody, fascism could co-opt anybody. Like anyone could be co-opted. No one's immune to that.
So can you talk to us a little bit about? Well, not even a little bit, but like, can you talk to me, talk to us about some of your activism that you do?
Sure.
What's your flavor of activism?
Yeah. So it's a couple things. My 9-to-5 is like supporting advocacy for immigrant rights in New York State and city, and also a little bit of the federal stuff. I'm a happy cog in the operation, but you know, I also like know my lane. I like as a white man would feel very weird taking like a front row role or whatever, like a leader, you know. So happy to be a operations logistics type of dude. That's very happy to, but then you know, and contribute my thoughts as needed.
So what brought you into that? Like what was
I was in another job that was not cool. That was like just a desk thing that was not me. And I got laid off and someone who I met in my activism with the Democratic Socialists of America, you know, recommended me for this job. And, you know, at DSA is, I work with them a lot.
Yeah.
I was a member of the South Brooklyn Organizing Committee of DSA for a couple years. I, you know, have been, you know, part of its electoral field operations before. Like I've trained hundreds of canvassers before for different candidates we've endorsed. And I've done, you know, like martial and public safety, you know, work with the DSA, marshaling like organization or, you know, I don't know what you call it. And so I do stuff like, you know, I'm involved in like street protests for like anti-police, anti-racist stuff too. That's another thing I do. And trying to think through how to do that in a productive, safe way.
So,
safe for the protesters. I don't give a shit about safe for the cops or property that can, that's whatever.
So I imagine you've been really busy with that stuff this last year.
Yeah, and initially I had to like, when it first really, really blew up in the early summer, because of COVID, and because like I just didn't know what was up and what I had, I like, and my mom was very, very vulnerable due to her health. And like, I just, like, as I was still in that like 10 block bubble, very limited sort of life, I kind of waited a little bit, like several weeks after that first initial like bunch of protests, to be like, are people getting COVID from this? It's like, it'd be one thing for me to risk myself. But like then I was like helping my mom with stuff, or, you know, like this is when we didn't even know whether like surface transmission was an issue yet for COVID. And I got in and started going to actions and marches, and it coincided with pushes for the New York City Council to defund the police, which they did not, and they basically did a whole like shell game that made it look like they took money away from the cops, and they ultimately didn't. And that's still ongoing. It's still an ongoing fight, and that budget is coming back up for consideration. So I'll be in the streets for that. Been active. Yeah, very active as a result.
That's what's up, man. Well, yo, it's been super fucking dope talking to you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, man. Where can people find you at? Your music and just your work?
So if they just go on, if they Google me, you know what? Actually, screw that. Go to the platforms themselves. I think that's the best way. Spell my name SOULKHAN. And whether that's in searching on Spotify, on Tidal, Apple Music, or on Twitter, Instagram, I'm usually SoulKhan on everything. At Facebook, like, although I'm not on Facebook as much lately on my fan page, you know, like, and there's, I just dropped a project, I shouldn't say just, it's almost a year ago, but in July, dropped an EP called Grow Up. It's really good. I think people should listen to it. It's on Soul Spasm. I think unfortunately their timing was kind of set, and I didn't know how to change that, and it got overshadowed by everything happening, and that's okay. It would be weird to complain about that. But if they see, like, if people are like, oh, I like SoulKhan, but I didn't realize you released anything, there's probably a reason, because the other more important stuff was going on.
Yeah.
And still goes on. I'm hopefully going to release another thing by the summer. Another EP, and we'll see from there. And hopefully people like that. And I'll be doing more videos of me rapping, just in my home probably.
Yeah.
And it should be cool. And I hope people enjoy the music. If they ever see me promoting something that they can get involved in politically, I encourage them to. And if people have questions about how to get more involved in many types of activism, I'm happy to point them in the right direction if I'm not the right person to get them involved. And my main priority right now is doing whatever I can while being a healthy person to further a better world.
That's what's up, man.
That's it.
Yes, sir. That was battle rapper extraordinaire SoulKhan. I was really looking forward to that interview. I'm really glad I got a chance to finally do that. It's funny. I'd been watching his clips on YouTube for the longest time, and then I was just by chance doing a show in Brooklyn, and he was in the crowd, and I saw him
And he was just there, like, super incognito and shit. I was like, yo, motherfucker, I know who you is. You know?
Yeah, trying to act like you just a normal, just, oh, I'm just a fan. Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, y'all make sure y'all check out some of his stuff. Not only, you know, the things that he's into politically, but y'all also check out some of his music and some of his battles online. But let's get into this music discussion. We're going to be taking it back, talking about some classic battle tracks just over the years. The art of battling on wax is a completely different animal, you know, in itself. You got the battling on stage, but then you have another art form in itself, which is when two people have a problem with each other and they write raps about it and record whole songs that live on forever and ever.
Yeah.
So up first, we're going to be going back to probably what is considered, you know, the most, not the first battle, but like the most impactful battle.
Actually, I think this is by many considered the first rap battle.
Like, really? Yeah. Like the first rap? Like, nobody somewhere did this before this happened?
Well, this was like the first, like, at a show, like in the spirit of like 8 Mile, like at a venue.
Okay.
Two famous rappers like had a battle against each other. Yeah. And this was at the Harlem World Christmas Celebration in December of 1981. Cool Moe Dee went up against Busy Bee in, I guess, you know, at least most celebrated, but by many considered like the quintessential first rap battle.
It used to be that, like, mainly, like, party rockers would win battles. And, you know, as long as you get the crowd hype, the person who gets the crowd the hypest is the one who wins. But this is, like, this is that instance where, you know, Kumo D got on stage and really just out-rapped Busy Bee and showed that, like, lyricism was, like, a whole new gear of taking this battle rap stuff into. So let's check out a little
bit. Right, because I think like at the inception of hip hop, the MC was sort of like a hype man for the DJ, and that, yeah, like it was about just adding an extra layer of cadence and like getting the crowd hyped up, etc. This was like, nah, actually you can take MC into a whole different level where, like, yeah, you'll see.
Yeah,
let's listen to a bit of it.
Everybody knows celebrity clubs are those kind you can win. It all set up before we come in. But in a battle like this, you know you lose. Between me and you, who do you think they'll choose? Well, if you think it's you, I got bad news. Because I hear your name, you're gonna hear some booze. Cause you're faking the funk. And at the end of this round, you can call me.
Yeah, I mean, it's like nuts that Busy Bee was like up there hyping the crowd and then called out Cool Moe Dee. Was in the venue, and Kool Moe Dee was like, nah, fuck that, and just like went on stage and just freestyled at Busy Bee like, hell nah.
And it was all hits. Yeah. like everything that Kool Moe Dee was, he wasn't wasting any motion. It was just all disses. Every line was a diss. But he eviscerated him, and that in turn, you know, grew the legend of Kool Moe Dee, who went on to have various other classic battles, you know, down the lines, including one famous one with LL Cool J.
Yeah, but let's hop on to the next one. We got between Boogie Down Productions, which is KRS-One, and Scott La Rock versus the Juice Crew. There's like a misunderstanding that the Juice Crew said that hip hop had started in Queens when BPD came out. So they came out with South Bronx. This, you know, a song about where, you know, the true, quote unquote, true birthplace of hip hop. And then Juice Crew responded with Kill That Noise. And then PPD came back with The Bridge Is Over,
which was a scathing.
Yes.
Scathing response. Let's check that out. Come to LDM. Manhattan keeps on making it. Brooklyn keeps on taking it. Bronx keeps creating it. And Queens keeps on faking it.
And so I feel like this was kind of the beginning of a trend that we see nowadays, where rappers who have beef will trade tracks and kind of go back and forth. Like, as we've moved from like an analog age into a more digital one, where you might not be in the same venue on the same night and calling each other out, but you might have SoundClouds and you might have Twitter and you might be talking shit at each other on these virtual platforms. like you go back and forth with like SoundCloud tracks about like, you know, fuck you, I heard you got a secret child, like also
so now et cetera. This adds like a new personal layer onto it too, because it's like what was once just like a competition that happens in the moment and then it's over. Now you're adding in the layer that it's like, hey, these disses are going to exist forever. It doesn't matter now that it's like 30 years later and these guys have probably, you know, a lot of them involved have probably like squashed beef or moved on or in different phases of their lives, but you have like this insult that you said about this other person that lives on forever. It's always going to be there. And not only that, but it's to slam in music that people are going to listen to forever. So I've only had one diss track made about me once, but it got the guys who did it took it down after I made my response shit.
And
it was my first, you know, I was looking forward to like going back and forth. I was like, oh man, how y'all gonna stop after just the first one? You know, I was just getting started. But that brings us that brings us to the last track that we got, which, I mean, in my opinion, you know, I've in preparation for this and just for other things, I must have listened to like 60 or 70 different battle tracks, obscure stuff that none of y'all even heard of because you didn't even know such and such were beefing and stuff like that. But I have to say, after listening to all those battle tracks, I think that this next joint is probably the best recorded battle track in hip hop's history, in my opinion. This is Cannabis with Second Round Knockout. Let's check this out.
Frontin' like a drug free role model, you disgust me. I know bitches that see you smoke weed recently. You walk around showing off your body cause it sells. Plus to avoid the fact that you ain't got scales. Mad at me cause I kick that shit real, niggas fail. Why 99% of your fans wear high heels? From Ice-T to Kumo D to Jay-Z.
Yeah, and so here we see a little bit of that like discursive hierarchy being created. Like when he's talking about like most of your fans were high heels. Implying that like, oh, you're more feminine because your fan base is feminine, well, et cetera. So reinforcing, you know.
Let me give a little backstory to this beef. So this was the Cannabis response in a battle between him and legendary rapper LL Cool J. And I can't believe that I'm old enough. You know what I'm saying? But it's crazy. So they did a music video shoot and Cannabis looked up to LL Cool J like, you know, like a god and shit. And this is 1998. Cannabis was a new rapper and he was doing this song with Method Man, Redman, DMX, and LL Cool J, right? So for Cannabis, this is like, oh, snap, I'm on this song with these guys. This is crazy. And LL Cool J has a famous microphone tattoo on his arm. So I guess something happened. Cannabis like made a comment about like, oh, I want like a microphone tattoo just like that. So they filmed the video and then L rewrote his verse and mentioned that conversation. Like, you can't grab this mic on my arm. So, you know, it was kind of like a diss and everybody knew it was a diss to Cannabis because Cannabis had then, you know, went and got a microphone tattooed on his arm and then that song came out. So Cannabis made this as like the response and it started like a whole thing between them, which you could make a whole documentary and a podcast about the battle between those two dudes in particular. But, oh man, where can I start? I mean, it definitely has cringe moments. You know, it's 1998 and obviously the sensibilities of it are definitely out of step today, but from just like a technical aspect of a battle rap song, it's again what Kumo D did in his freestyle back in the 80s. I think what Cannabis does with this is like he creates something where every line is about LL Cool J. You know, and for me, what made it refreshing at the time is that it was something that was solely based in rap and in music. This is coming off of the heels of Tupac and Biggie both getting killed because of some street shit that, you know what I mean, that the media kind of manipulated into being involved with music when it really wasn't. So for me, you know, it was like being young when the song came out and seeing that, it was like, nah, this was a beef between two rappers about how well they rap over some rap shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know, and like everything that they said about each other was based in that field of like, yo, I'm a better rapper than you. Even the line that the line of like 99% of your fans wear high heels is more in reference, you know, just at the time is more in reference to like, yo, you're not even rapping for people who like listening to rap. Because that was the stereotype back then, is that girls want to see LL Cool J with a shirt off and yada, 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 yada. So, but I mean, no, it's a classic. Just even thinking about that makes me smile. It's like, I wish that when rappers in the 2000s have beef with each other and they're making songs, that it's like a battle of wits and people like, you know what I mean? Like exaggerating ability and stuff like that. And not like, yo, I'll spray your grandmother with the drum. You know what I mean? And like, I pistol whip you with the, smack you with the tool. You know, it's like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just
you're right though. Nah, I mean, I've been talking about a lot of these shootings here in Athens in recent episodes, and I was talking to the father of one of these kids that got killed. Apparently, people was like jealous that he was blowing up musically, and people like, and like a bunch of people conspired to like take this 20-year-old child's life. So like, it goes like, yo, I'm gonna spray your car up, and then let people go literally go spray your car up.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Hey, if it's like, you know, the words are power, you know what I'm saying? It's like we all have the right to say what we want, but it's like shit can manifest, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
you know, to that extent, it's like you got to be mindful of things that you put out there in the world, you know. But that's it for us today. We are going to bounce, but you know we're going to be back next week with some dope shit.
Yes.
Hey, Joel, you drop a beat. Wait, no reparations. Yeah. Yo, who the hell iller the knife? Riddle me that. Do you all know where I'm lyrically at? I'm lyrically at a level levitating you chumps, cause I'm sitting in the woods meditating with monks. Then I'm breaking a blunt and I'm thinking a skunk, cause I gotta smoke like every day of the month. I won battles first place, not a fake or a stunt. Should I make your favorite rap after staying a slump? I'll rework it till it seemed perfect. I did freestyle battles, no rehearsed shit. I did freestyle battles, no rehearse shit.
Imagine me, I'm on stage, we batchlick, thinking to myself, look how he got gap teeth, do I attack these, or the fat keys, the class geek, I better slash deep, so I be going for his family, like, hey, how's your mom, I thought I saw her walking last week, or maybe I was passing the gas, he's trashy, but I look a little closer, but the fragrance was so nasty, I had to hail a taxi to a different galaxy, now the crowd's clapping and gasping, I'm beating ass badly, but I feel a little sad, we be tearing each other down for props and spread, especially when he's at back, yo, my mom's dead.
I'm Lingua Franca.
I'm Dope Knife. And we are waiting on
reparations. And your mama sucks dicks in hell.
I hate everything about you. I hate the way you look.
Hey. But for real though, we see you next week.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.